This is Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Mike Dutton, Chief Executive Officer of Winder Farms. Winder's delivery vehicles have traversed the Utah landscape since 1880. Not only was that before cars, but it was also before electricity. Back then, John Winder and his family delivered milk and butter mostly to neighbors and friends. The company stayed in the family until 2004, when two local investment firms, Dolphin Capital and Peterson Partners, purchased Winder Dairy. Much has changed since 1880, but remarkably, much has also stayed the same. Winder still focuses on delivering farm-fresh produce to its neighbors and friends, only now the company has a lot more friends. In 2013, Winder delivered over 10 million products to customers in Utah, Nevada, and Southern California. Mike, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So when you think of Winder Farms business, how do you think of it? I mentioned in the open, farm fresh products to local consumers. Do you think of it as online grocery delivery, which is a really hot space now, or more of a niche type business?
So the way that we think about it is as a farmer's market on wheels. And so in some ways it's like a grocery store, but in other ways it's not. And the ways that we differ are, we really want to focus on that fresh section of the grocery store. And so we want to bring to customers all the fresh products that they need for their household. And so the reason for that, for the reason why we focus on that is because those are the products that you consume on a weekly basis. And so it's your dairy, it's your produce, it's your meats, it's your fresh prepared meals, it's bakery items. We source those locally, and then we deliver it to people's homes.
And, you know, Winder's probably been doing it longer than I would think almost anybody in the country. It'd be hard-pressed to find somebody that's been doing it longer. But there have been startups that have tried and failed at this concept, famously Webvan in the Bay Area. What did Webvan do wrong that caused it to not be able to succeed where you guys have been able to grow and thrive?
Yeah, great question. So when we first got involved in the business, I had friends that would tell me, well, do you remember Webvan? You know, home delivery of grocery doesn't work. You know, it wasn't just Webvan, but there were a series of companies that went public in the dot-com heyday that tried to do home delivery, and the model didn't work. I think what Winder has figured out is a way to make home delivery of groceries work, and that is we have a business that is a subscription business. And so when we sign up a customer, we say, you know, we're going to go to your house every Monday until you tell us to stop. And the reason why that's good for the business model is that we get incredible density along our routes. And so our average truck in Utah, when it goes out to make a delivery, it delivers to over 150 homes in a night. And so think about that. So we have one truck going to 150 homes where, you know, compare that to a home delivery grocer, which says, you know, get online, deliver to my house, and they're going to only deliver to maybe 10 homes in a day. Because ours is a predictable service, we can have incredible route density. And that's a key difference between us and other types of models that came in the past. That's one reason. The second reason is the way that we focused on our product. And so we only deliver those fresh items from a grocery store. And those fresh items are generally higher margin. And so if we were to focus on all the products in the grocery store, you know, we don't want to compete on all the products that people can get from any grocery store and compete on that price level. What we want to do is we want to say, hey, listen, we've got a premium set of products priced at a bit of a premium, but we're going to deliver it to your door. And that's where we can have a profitable business while the others could not.
You know, I knew about the subscription service, but I didn't think about how key that can be to your business model. And I can see where that makes a difference. You know, another thing that makes a difference is density. And I moved here, you and I actually both moved here from the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Bay Area is a great place to live. I prefer living in Utah, which is why I live here. And one of the things I like is we do have some wide open spaces here, mm-hmm. which is great for me as a person that loves outdoor recreation. Not so great for a delivery service. So how do you make it work in the less dense areas?
Yeah, so we really focus along the Wasatch Front. So between, you know, kind of the metropolitan area of Ogden going through Salt Lake and then the metropolitan area of Provo, there's almost 2 million people. And so, yeah, we've got great wide open spaces in Utah, and that's why I like living here. But along the Wasatch Front, we actually have a pretty dense population. And so our service wouldn't really work servicing very rural areas. We work in urban and suburban markets. And that's why even when we look at expanding into new markets, we look for a nice, you know, we want to have more than 1 million consumers in within an hour's radius of our distribution center. That's really what's required to build a business like ours, because
that's sufficient density.
You don't need
to have 5 million people.
No, okay. No. You know, when we look at, you know, we have recently expanded into Southern California. You know, that's a market of 20 million people, and we're very excited about that. But you've got to take that one piece at a time. So really for us, the metric is to have about 1 million people in it within an hour's drive, and then we can build very dense routes in that system.
Does it surprise you that some big players, Amazon being famous among them, are kind of dusting off the web van business plan and really delivering everything, kind of the whole grocery experience, not focusing on the niche, not doing subscription, but really saying as long as the town is dense enough, we can make it work. So Amazon's in Seattle, San Francisco, and they just recently said they're going to do New York City. Do you think they're going to meet with success, or are you skeptical that that can work?
I think they'll meet with success. I think the reason why companies like Amazon and others are entering this market is it's one of the last bastions of, you know, of big markets that have not been revolutionized by the web. If you look at any other consumer category.
It's a huge industry, right? It's over $1 trillion.
Over a trillion. It's about 12% of GDP. It's food. And so if you look at any other consumer category, you know, the size of the food industry dwarfs, you know, books and media and music and all these other categories that have been revolutionized by the web. And so big companies, you know, not just Amazon, but Google and others are looking at, you know, how to effectively get food purchased online and delivered to consumers' homes. And so I look at that and I say, you know what, I don't fear companies like Amazon entering the market. If I look at the grocery industry, it's highly fragmented today. You know, if you even look in the market in Salt Lake, there are, you know, dozens of grocery stores and each serving a different niche. And what we're going to focus on is those farmers market products delivered locally, high quality, delivered to people's homes. And Amazon's going to focus on, you know, non-fresh items, center of the store. And there'll be other people who focus on other segments of the market. And I think that because very little food is bought online today, you know, going from 0% of food to 10% of food.
Of a $1 trillion business.
There's going to be a lot of winners.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I hope you're right. It's interesting to see that. And I'm glad that your hope, it sounds like you're actually hoping Amazon's successful. You think they will be. You think there is a model for them. But yet you think there's room for both players.
Absolutely. And the markets where they're in, you know, we look at Seattle. There's a company similar to us in Seattle that's thriving. You know, customers take deliveries from Amazon for certain products and, you know, from this other company, the fresh products. And so I definitely think that we can coexist.
That's great to hear. From a personal standpoint, I want to solve this grocery thing because, you know, one of the subjects my wife and I will occasionally argue over is who's going to do the grocery shopping. We both hate it. Yeah. And the reality is it's 90% of it's the same stuff week after week. So it really does lend itself to online delivery. Although I think it'll be a long time until Amazon enters the Utah market just because of the density issue. Let's move on. So you got involved with Winder when Dolphin and Dolphin Capital and Peterson Partners purchased the company. What was Winder? It was called Winder Dairy back then. What was Winder Dairy like then? And what were some of the first things that you wanted to introduce or maybe change?
Yeah. So Winder back then, it was your stereotypical milkman business. You know, the company has been around since 1880, and the way that they operated the business was very similar in, you know, 2004 as it was in 1880. They owned cows, they bottled the milk, and they delivered it to people's homes. Now it started off in, you know, horse and carriage, and then went to trucks, and, you know, so they evolved a bit, but the basic business model had not changed. They thought of the business as a dairy and as home delivery as a way of getting, you know, those products to consumers. When we looked at the business, we looked at it as, hey, this is a home delivery grocer that's only delivering dairy today. And so kind of our creativity was, well, let's take the base of dairy and add these other products and increase the value that we can bring to consumers. And that was really a big fundamental change. The second one was technology. You know, when you have a business that has operated a certain way for a long time, you know, the there wasn't the innovation on the technology side.
And was that because it's expensive to put these? I mean, they knew about the family knew, hey, there's some technologies that will pay for themselves over time, but we've got to write a pretty big check to get them in. Was it that, or was it just a commitment to doing it the old-fashioned way?
I think it was a little bit of both. I think what happens sometimes in family businesses, and the Winder family is still a shareholder today, and they've been great.
And some of the family members still work at Winder,
they do,
Dairy, which I think is really cool.
And they've been great partners. But I think what happens as a business gets passed down from generation to generation, also the shareholder base gets more distributed. And so you don't have as many single shareholders whose entire livelihood is dependent upon the company. And so the impetus to act and to invest in the future is just not there as much as, you know, it is with a company with a more concentrated shareholder base.
Okay. So I'm going to paraphrase what I heard you say is really the ability to invest fresh capital to get into bring some cost savings and some technology, and also looking at the business as a channel, delivery channel, and what else could you put through the channel that was high value add was really what you were looking at. That said, as you just mentioned, the Winder family's a shareholder in the company today. You've got another investment group, Peterson Partners, and your partners at Dolphin Capital. So we've got at least three entities that are looking at this. Often it's hard to get all three entities in agreement that, hey, this really is the right thing to do. What was that process like saying, okay, here's what we think the game plan is. Now we all have to agree on it and then execute it. Was it pretty clear to everybody that this is what you needed to do, or did it take 6 months, 12 months to get everybody on board?
Yeah, it took that 6 to 12 months to get everybody on board. What we wanted to do is, you know, we had a general thesis when we made the investment of, you know, transition to home delivery grocer. And everybody was on board with that thesis at the beginning, but we didn't really know if that meant, you know, we're going to launch, you know, 20,000 items like they have in the grocery store, or are we going to focus on, you know, convenience items, or are we going to focus on fresh items? We said, you know what, we're new to this business. Let's just learn for a while. And, you know, our strategy was, let's spend a year learning the business, and then we're going to fundamentally change it. The reality is, once we got there and we were in for 90 days, we had a very clear point of view of what we wanted to do, and I think everybody rallied behind that. It wasn't a hard sell. Everybody said, okay, we need to adapt, and we've brought on these partners, and they've got great ideas. Let's go.
Good, because I know oftentimes that can be a challenge. I suspect one of the more controversial decisions you mentioned when your group and your partners bought Winder Dairy. They owned cows. And I'm assuming by that you no longer own cows. So somewhere along the way, you made the decision, you know what, we're going to contract with other dairy farmers that are producing milk in a wholesome way, the same way the Winder family did. But it's different. That's a huge mindset change to buy milk versus producing the milk. How controversial was that?
Yeah, no, it was a very controversial decision. I mean, especially for a company whose culture had always been dairy. And so there was really two reasons to do it. One was symbolic and one was economic. And the symbolic reason was, we want to make a statement to really our employee base that we're going to be much more than milk. And the company had always sourced some of its milk from local farms. And so the transition to go from a part of it coming from local farms to all of it was not that risky because we already had great farm partners. To exit the dairy business, though, was, you know, it was also on the economic side, it was simplifying the business. If you think about Winder is under one roof. At the time, it was a food producer. It was a dairy. It was a consumer products goods company because we have our own brand that we manage. It was UPS because we have our whole, you know, distribution system. And it was a customer service and marketing firm. We've got 100 salespeople.
It's a pretty complex business.
It's too complex for the size of business that it was. So to take the production side and say, you know what, we're gonna find partners to do that and focus on the other aspects was absolutely the right call.
Are some of the Winder family members still involved in their own dairy farms?
Not any that I deal with on a daily basis. But, you know, John R. Winder, the founder, was six generations ago. So there's probably a Winder somewhere who is a dairy farmer.
Yeah. All right. Well, I can see that's part of their heritage.
It is.
Part of what they grown up with. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Mike Dutton, CEO of Winder Farms. So let's switch gears. So you made those changes in 2004. Economy's doing well. Winder's doing well. You're getting some traction. You're getting a lot of traction, actually. And you decide to expand into Las Vegas in 2007. I like to go down to Vegas for a couple days every year. That's about as long as I can go down there for. But they seem like very different markets, not just from a value standpoint, but just from a community standpoint. And as you mentioned, these are niche products that you can sell at a premium. It takes some level of affluence and commitment to healthy living. And here in Utah, I think there's a lot of us that are concerned about our health and we want to eat well. And there's certainly those folks in Vegas as well, but probably fewer on a percentage basis. Why was Vegas the next natural market? And what am I missing? Why does Vegas make sense where, to me, it seems like a misfit?
So Vegas made sense for us for a few reasons. One is we looked at our headquarters in Salt Lake City, and we drew an 11-hour radius around that, which is where the Department of Transportation will allow you to ship with one truck in one day, 11 hours from its point of origination. And so in those markets, there's Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, Las Vegas, Southern California.
You drive faster than me if you can get to San Francisco in 11 hours.
Yeah, you can get to the verge of San Francisco.
Okay.
And so we looked at all those markets. You know, Denver was another one. And we marked certain off the list because they're just too far out, just a little bit on the fringes of the 11 hours. And other ones we marked out for competitive reasons. And so that really left, you know, Las Vegas as the best market for us to go into because we're already in St. George. So it's only another hour and a half from St. George. And demographically, actually, it looks a lot like the Wasatch Front. Family size, household income, growth rates. And so...
That's surprising.
Yeah.
But okay, that's one of the pieces that I was missing.
Yeah, it's family size.
Okay.
And also, you know, families within our core demographic of college educated, higher income, the size of that market looks a lot like the Wasatch Front. The third issue was there's a lot of Salt Lake transplants who live in Las Vegas. And so for us to go to a market where there was at least some knowledge and recognition of our brand, we thought would be helpful.
Okay. So that was 2007. As I mentioned, you know, we bought Winder in 2004. The economy's doing well. 2007, boy, it seemed like everything was starting to hit on all cylinders. There were a couple scary headlines showing up in the Wall Street Journal. And then 2008 happens, which is a very scary time, right? People cut back on disposable spending quite a bit and very, very quickly. What was that cycle like for you guys, and what kind of changes did you have to do to survive that?
Yeah, no, it was a scary time because also for us, launching into a new market requires a significant capital investment because not only do we have to open up the distribution center and buy the trucks, we also have to fuel our business with cash until we build up that recurring revenue stream. And so we have to, you know, spend sales and marketing dollars to build up a customer base to support all that infrastructure. And so when the economy crashed, we were still making those investments to, you know, get that market to profitability. So, you know, it was we were not sure really what the impact would be, you know, in Las Vegas. And Las Vegas, you know,
it was really impacted. The recession. Yeah,
yeah,
they really got hit.
Population declined in Las Vegas. You know, home values went down a lot more there than they did here. But what we were surprised to find is that our business actually consistently grew through that period. And one of the reasons for that is that we are, you know, we're very dependent upon a sales and marketing organization. And as the economy went down there and unemployment went up, our ability to hire people into sales and marketing was a lot easier. And so while maybe signing up new customers became more difficult, we're actually able to hire more salespeople and to grow through that period.
So even in your core business here in the Wasatch Front, you did not see a lot of people cutting back on the service.
No.
I'm surprised.
Our order value stayed the same. It became more difficult to sign up a single customer, but it became more easy to hire sales reps. And so actually we were able to grow through that period.
So it's the orders per salesperson went down, but you were able to increase more sales your sales force.
Okay. And the salespeople were able to preserve their income because our revenue per customer was able to make up for that difference.
Well, I think that really speaks highly to the value people put on your service, because I would have guessed you'd have a lot of people that said, you know what? We're going to have to, you know, go to the grocery store, and we love your produce. It's better, but for the next 6 months, we're going to compromise and we're going to cut back. But this is not an area people cut back on, which I think is huge accolades to you guys. So opening Vegas was expensive, took capital, and it probably didn't grow as quickly for the reasons we talked about. Did the investor group have to put fresh capital in as well, or were you able to fund it through the cash flows of the core business?
Yeah, we were able to fund it through the cash flow of the core business.
That's great. That makes it a lot easier. In part of the research for our conversation today, I saw an interview that you did earlier where you said you've grown five times over the last 5 years. Winder Dairy is five times larger today. What do you think's driven that kind of growth? That's spectacular growth. First off, congratulations.
Thanks. And, you know, what's driven that? You know, Winder has a great heritage and a great team. The growth has come from our current customers giving us license to sell more to them. And so for a long time, all they bought from us was milk. And then we said, hey, you know, why don't you try our produce? And why don't you try our bakery items? And why don't you try our meats? And so, you know, half of that growth rate has come from just us increasing the amount of products that current customers are buying from us. And so when we got into the business, virtually 100% of our revenue came from milk. Today, it's about a third of our revenue comes from milk. And so milk has maintained steady. It's just that all these other categories have allowed us to grow. And so we've been able to capture just a larger share of wallet from those consumers. So that's one issue. And then the second one has been that geographic expansion. And
so we talked about Vegas. You also made the decision to go into Southern California. We're going to come back to that because I think that's going to be a really interesting piece of the story as well. But what I want to talk about now is while milk is now less than a third, I moved to Utah in 1998, thought I was moving here for 2 or 3 years, and now almost 20 years later, we're still loving living here. But when I moved here, there was no Winder Dairy, Winder Milk in the grocery stores. And now I see it in all the grocery stores. And my kids, your branding is great because, you know, my kids, that's what they want to drink, right? And so when Dad decides to save a dollar and buy the non-Winder Dairy, I hear about it when I come home. How did you guys get into that business? And was that a difficult sale? Do the grocery stores view you in some ways as being competitors with them, or was that something they welcomed?
Yeah. So the way that we think about it is it's a way to develop our brand. And so we have one channel of delivery, which is home delivery, and we have another very important channel, which is the grocery stores. The grocery stores see it as, you know, they also want to deliver more local product. And so when you have consumers who are willing to, you know, go into a store and pay a premium for a local brand, you know, grocery stores want to participate in that. And you're about to see more of our product in grocery stores. We're now in the process of launching with several grocery stores milk in glass bottles. It's been a trend that has, you know, really
just feels good.
It feels good. It tastes more premium. It's environmentally friendly. In California, there's a big movement towards milk in glass bottles. You know, we're uniquely, you know, positioned to do it. We want to capture that market opportunity. And so I think grocery stores see, you know, they see us as, you know, additive to their dairy category and really not competitive. You know, most of our consumers, you know, well, all of our customers for home delivery, they still shop at grocery stores.
Sure, because you don't deliver everything that the grocery store offers.
Right.
They have, by definition, they almost have to.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, and I was surprised to see that not only are you in the grocery stores, but you're the number two selling private brand or branded milk in Utah. I mean, that's amazing. First off, who's number one?
Oh, Doug, does it matter who number one is? I don't know who number one is, but I was surprised. You've done your research. Yeah, and we use that research to go into grocery stores and say, hey, listen, you know, our product sells. Customers want to buy this local brand. And so we've come out of nowhere to become, I guess, now the number two brand in Utah.
And how long was that something you guys started in 2004? Or is that something over the last 3 or 4 years?
It's really been probably the last 5 years that we've been in grocery stores.
That's amazing to go from nothing in grocery stores to number two in the grocery store. And it begs the question, which you guys are about to explore, what would happen if you started offering your chocolate chip cookies and some of the other products that you offer that are kind of unique to you guys?
Right.
So we mentioned Southern California. So first it was Vegas. Then you decided to expand into Orange County. And there was another player. Mm-hmm. You made the decision rather than compete head-to-head with that player to buy that company. How did you decide on that being your third market? And then how did you decide to buy versus compete or build?
Yeah. So the reason why we chose Southern California as our third market is just sheer market size. You know, we wanted to be in a very big market. And once you have a foothold in Southern California, there's lots of adjacent markets within Southern California that you can expand to. And it was only 4 hours from where we were in Las Vegas. And so just kind of, you know, continuing down I-15, we can continue to deliver to California. The buy versus build decision was really opportunistic. We decided we wanted to be in Southern California. We surveyed the market. We found a company, a milk delivery company, much like Winder of old, that we could acquire and apply the same learnings to that business as we applied to Winder. This acquisition was much smaller, and so it was a easier decision to say, let's start with that platform.
How many delivery trucks did they have?
They had 6 delivery trucks.
Wow, so it was tiny.
It was very tiny.
Wow.
But it was a platform to start with.
Did it buy you enough? The 6 delivery trucks gave you enough of a platform that it was worth doing it that way?
Yeah, because you have a recurring revenue stream to start with. And you have an employee base to start with, and you have a distribution center to start with. And so there's a lot of risk in going to a new market and just starting from scratch. Now, we had just done it in Las Vegas, and so I think our eyes were open to, you know, all that entails. But we were able to find another company there. The owner wanted to transition. It just was.
The owner must have been beside himself with joy that you guys were in trade. Who do you sell a company that has 6 delivery vehicles to? Nobody, right?
That's right.
I mean, you give it to your kids, or unfortunately, it goes out of business when the founder doesn't want to do it anymore. That was a godsend. Did he approach you? Did he say, hey, Winder, I see you're in Vegas. Would you be interested in my business? Or did you guys approach him?
We approached him.
God, he went home and he told his wife, you're not going to believe the phone call I just got.
Yeah. You know, and even then, it was still a 3-year process to get him on board.
Was he hesitant to sell?
He was hesitant to sell because it was his life.
You should have had him give me a call. I would have told him not only sell, but sell now. You just won the lottery.
I should have, Doug.
Yeah. That's funny. And how about employees? How many employees?
They had, 20 or so employees.
And how big were you guys at the time between Utah and Vegas, employees?
Employee-wise, you know, 250-plus.
So huge cultural change.
Huge cultural change.
For that group. Your job number one when you bought Winder Dairy was to learn the business for the first 6 months. Very different experience when you went into Orange County. Your job number one was, we have a winning formula, and we're going to transition you to it fairly quickly. I'm guessing. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So there were 20 employees, some of which, I'm guessing a half dozen, were like, I love the new plan. And the other employees were like, oh, I kind of like the old way. What was that transition like for that team down there?
Yeah, you know, I think they were excited for the transition. They saw all the things that we had done at Winder were things that they wanted to do. You know, a great website, mobile ordering, you know.
They had overnight because you had the system.
Exactly.
You just turn the switch and they have it.
Exactly. You know, so we made, in many ways, we made their lives better. We made, you know, the trucks easier to run because of, you know, routing software. And so they all got on board. The reality, though, is, you know, the biggest transition is the owner doesn't want to stay with the business once it's sold. And so we had to make sure that we had a clean transition of leadership. And so we took somebody here and we moved them there, and they were able to, you know, transplant our culture to a new office.
So you can tell I'm surprised that this company, I did my research, but I wasn't able to find how big the company was that you bought. 6 delivery vehicles, which makes the press release that your company put out 9 months later all the more remarkable, which is in the first year in Orange County, you guys signed up 10,000 households.
Yep.
You probably don't have this data, but Winder Dairy was started in 1880. How long did it take Winder Dairy to sign up? I'm guessing a couple decades.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that
long,
would be
long
fun,
time.
Fun to look
How
at.
How about Vegas? How long did it take to sign up 10,000 customers in Vegas?
Oh, we signed up 10,000 probably the first 18 months.
Really?
In Vegas, yeah.
Okay. Orange County even quicker.
Yeah.
Do you think that that speaks more to the region or to the fact that you started with a platform versus Greenfield?
I think it's because we started with a platform and we were able to apply lessons learned. You know, now we've got a formula for customer acquisition, both, you know, with sales reps and online, that we can turn on in new markets.
And you've got a team that, if need be, you can take down their coach and very quickly get the team on location on the program that you know that works.
That's right.
So Orange County is a remarkable place. I used to spend a fair amount of time down there. I prefer to be a little further south in San Diego, but it's still a neat town. 3 million people in Orange County alone. Whole state of Utah is a little over 2 million. So it's just remarkable the density that you have there. Do you think you're still in the early stages of being able to sign up folks in that area? And can you see a day in the not too distant future where maybe Southern California is your biggest market?
Yeah, I think over time it will become our biggest market. There are differences between, you know, and we're learning as we go. You know, we don't have it all figured out there. But, you know, that market is much more focused on organic than what we see in Las Vegas or Salt Lake City. And so we're transitioning the product offering there to be more organic. And so I do think that over time, just because of the sheer size of Southern California, that it will become our largest market. But our business model will also have to evolve to be unique to that market. You know, we've got to find local vendors that are beloved in Orange County and offer those, you know, on our routes. We've got to have more organic. You know, today in Utah, about 15% of the produce that we sell is organic. In California, it's 60%. And so there's we're looking at adding specific product managers just to focus on California to take advantage of that.
Interesting. So we're talking about the advantages of Southern California. It's still California. California is a tough place to do business. What are some things that make it harder to build a successful company? Now that you've been there for a while, what have you found? What are some differences doing business in California, just from dealing with the state, dealing with the legislature, dealing with the rules and regulations? What's different in California versus Utah?
Yeah, so that was a ramp up for us. You know, even we found that when we quickly grew out of the facility that we started with. And so we had to move into the facility. And we've done, we've moved into new facilities all the time. We've got 6 distribution centers across Utah. You know, the process of getting permitted in Southern California was a much more difficult process than it was in Utah. Just the stages that we had to go through to approve basically a warehouse that has cooling in it was much more difficult there than it is here. There's also rules that govern, things like overtime and wages that are different in California. So we've had to adapt our pay plans in California, which makes it just a more expensive market to do business in.
Yeah, I think I think Utah is a very pro-business state, and I think our leaders in the political arena here in Utah deserve kudos for making it such a friendly and relatively easy place to do business, particularly when you move from California. When I first moved here, Linda and I have a friend, Nicole Toomey Davis. We were over her house for dinner, and I was talking about something. I mean, this was 10-plus years ago. And Nicole gave me a call a week later, and she's like, I was just meeting with the governor last week, and I shared with him your idea, and he thinks it's a good idea. And I was like blown away, because in California, that doesn't happen. Your friend doesn't say, I was just talking to the governor about your idea. We're here in Utah. If you're a business person, if you think the state should do something different, you know what? The state's pretty receptive to hearing it and considering it.
Yeah, and we have found that. You know, from time to time, we've got issues that we can have that we would like the state's input or help on, and they've been very accessible. We have definitely had that experience.
Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk some more with Mike Dutton, CEO of Winder Farms. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today, we're speaking with Mike Dutton, Chief Executive Officer of Winder Farms. I mentioned in the opening, and we've talked about it several times, Winder Dairy started 1880. And then I also casually mentioned that you still have a couple employees. They're Kent Winder and Amy Winder Newton, fifth and sixth generation family members are still involved in the business. How important is that to maintaining the cultural history of the company?
Yes. For me, it's very important. We try to run the company like a family-owned business. We have employees who have been there literally for 50-plus years. We had a driver manager recently retire who worked at the company for 55 years before retiring. And we don't want to lose that culture.
That's amazing, 55 years. You don't hear stories like that anymore.
And he's an amazing person. And we've got many employees who have been there for over 30 years. My assistant has been there for over 20 years. And so there's just we don't want to lose that culture. And so, particularly Kent Winder is very good about, getting up at employee meetings and sharing stories that connect what we're doing today to the past. Amy is a spokesperson for us. We had her doing a series of TV shows on one of the local networks, and is very good about bringing in kind of the folksy stories of the past, and those become part of the corporate lore of Winder. So I love having the Winders involved in the business. I think it makes our company, we think of ourselves as the oldest startup in Utah. And so we can have this, startup, we're going to conquer the world.
I love that phrase, the oldest startup in Utah. That's great.
Yeah, because we want to change the world. We have that attitude. We really exist to build healthy communities through great food, and people are inspired by that mission. But at the same time, we can point back to, 100 years of history, and we're a company that's going to be around for a long time. And I think, being able to have both of those is a great part of our culture.
Yeah, no, I agree. And again, I love that phrase because it connects your heritage to your current vision. And it's really hard to do that with a company that's, over 100 years old. So
right.
I love that. Let's talk about your journey now. So we've talked about Winder Dairy, Winder Farms, and kind of their journey. But for you personally, so you wear several hats in addition to being the chief executive officer at Winder Farms. You work with Dolphin Capital. Let's start there. What does Dolphin Capital do?
Yeah, so Dolphin Capital is a private equity firm that we invest in growing mid-sized companies. We like to invest in companies that have kind of a dual mission to build a great business, but are also doing good for humanity.
So you talk about employees that have been with Winder for 50-plus years. Your journey with Dolphin maybe not 50 years, but it's going to last pretty long. I mean, you joined Eric Jacobson and Dan Schley.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of undergrad at BYU. You were with them, if I'm correct, at Home Financial Network. What attracted you to work with Eric and Dan right out of BYU as opposed to, trying to get a job with a Fortune 500 company, which I'm sure a lot of your classmates, that was the path that they wanted to go. What attracted you to what Eric and Dan were doing?
Right. So actually, right out of undergrad, I did go work for a Fortune 500 company.
There you go. Okay. I wasn't far off. But you left for pretty quickly.
I did, yeah. So I worked for a large consulting firm. Anderson Consulting. And then after 2 years there, I decided, I really want to do something more entrepreneurial, more creative. And I met Eric and Dan at Home Financial Network. And what they were doing at the time was, really building the first generation of internet banking software. And to me, that just sounded really interesting to be at the forefront of doing something new. This was back in, the mid-90s of building this technology. And so, they are very passionate, successful entrepreneurs. I decided that long-term, I really want to be an entrepreneur myself. And so to partner with some guys like that was a great opportunity for me. And so I joined there as a product manager, and I worked my way up to, running marketing for that company until we eventually sold it.
I was just going to say, and that was a very successful company. It sold for $130 million to Sybase.
Mm-hmm.
You stayed on at Sybase for a little bit, which is a big company. And did that contrast both the experience you had at Home Financial Network, going through the acquisition, now you're with a big company. Did that kind of cement in your mind that your life's work was more along this entrepreneurial path than the big company path?
Absolutely. Yep. I saw how excited I was about creating an industry and creating new products versus going in and managing a process with a big company. I just knew that, long-term, I wanted to be in business for myself.
And Eric and Dan have interesting backgrounds as well. If I'm not mistaken, Dan has his MBA from Harvard Business School. Eric decided not to get his MBA. And so you worked through this transition. You had a nice success. You realized you wanted to be an entrepreneur. And ultimately, you decided to go to Stanford Business School. Really hard to get into. Congrats for cracking that nut. It's a tough nut to crack. But did you kind of weigh, is it right now there's a big debate, right? Peter Thiel's paying people to not go to college because you're smart, you don't need to start. It's a different world today. Mm-hmm. I don't think he could have done that when you went to business school. But was the decision to go to business school and get your MBA, was that an easy one for you? Or was that one that you gave a lot of thought to and struggled with?
Yeah, it was an easy one for me. I saw it as, I wanted to build, for me an MBA was about really developing a base knowledge of all things business. I had an undergraduate degree in political science, and so I came out knowing basically how to read and write, but not knowing a lot about business, and learned some things on the way, but I wanted this kind of toolkit that I could get in an MBA program. That was part of it, but that really the other part was just a life experience. I wanted to go do something unique that you can only do at a certain time in your life. If you don't do it, then you can never get that opportunity again. And so for me, it was, hey, let's go out to California. Let's go have a great experience, meet lots of cool people, and do some entrepreneurial things while I was in school. So that's what it was for me.
And I want to talk about the entrepreneurial thing you did while you were in school. But before we go there, I want to spend a little more time on this, the value of an MBA. And it's funny, at the time, my brother-in-law, so when I got accepted to business school, my brother-in-law did this Excel analysis on how I would not benefit financially from an MBA. When you take into the cost, you're going to take 2 years off of work, blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of surprised by the whole thing, because for me, it was the life experience. It was not a quantitative decision. It's in hindsight paid off in spades, but whether it did or did not, it was, you only get one life, and it was a part of my life experience that I wanted to have. And so I, for folks that are listening or maybe advising other people on whether to get their MBA or not, I would encourage you to really weigh heavily what the life experience is like. And it's a wonderful opportunity. You go to college undergrad, and you go to college, you're 17 or 18 years old, you really don't know what you want to do. Now, you tend to get your MBA later in life. You have a better idea of what you want to do, and you can surround yourself with interesting people that also share that passion. And it's very valuable whether or not the regression analysis when you're 65 years old shows that, financially it paid off. I suspect it will, but even if it doesn't, it's worthwhile. But let's go to, before I got off on my little soapbox there, it's an important topic.
It is. I would also say that, you probably like me, some of my best friends in the world are people that I met at business school. And so whether I could quantify that, I couldn't quantify that in a spreadsheet, but as far as my total life experience is better for having had that experience.
And frankly, I'm kind of surprised Peter Thiel is on this soapbox. I don't disagree that some of these kids are going to be able to build very successful businesses, but it's still a life experience that I don't think you want to trade lightly.
Right.
And so I'm kind of surprised by as convicted as he is. He's a very bright guy, very successful. He's one of the co-founders with Elon Musk of PayPal. He's also a Stanford MBA, though. So, while he's telling people not to do this, he's gotten that experience. But anyways, a little bit of a tangent. I apologize for that. You mentioned your entrepreneurial venture that you started in business school. It was called Genus Group. Mm-hmm. What did Genus do?
So what we did is we produced technology trade shows. And so, before heading to business school, I was a VP of marketing for a software company and would spend a lot of money marketing our software at trade shows. And I always thought, this has to be a great business. For what I was paying as a head of marketing to be at a trade show, I looked at the economics of
that. It is a great business.
Yeah. And I thought, I want to be in that business. Right. And so, with a couple of friends, we had this idea for, technology conferences that we could produce. And so, during business school, we launched this company and had, a really nice run with it.
Nice. And you ended up selling that.
Yeah. Actually, the same day that I graduated from business school, I sold that company exact same day.
That's crazy.
It was a busy day.
It was a very busy day. If you're just joining us, our guest this morning is Mike Dutton, CEO of Winder Farms and partner at Dolphin Capital. So you go to business school, graduate, you look at the various alternatives, you want to be an entrepreneur. Did you graduate in 2002 or 2004?
Four.
Four, okay. So as you're looking at it, it's the same time that your old partners, Eric Jacobson and Dan, are through Dolphin Capital and Peterson Partners buying Winder Dairy, and you make the decision to join Dolphin at that time. How'd you make the decision to go back with the team that you were with versus starting a new experience?
Yeah, you know, it was in hindsight, it was a tough decision, but, you know, at the time it was a tough decision, but in hindsight, I'm so glad that I made that call. So my second year of business school, Eric and I started to look at some private equity type deals. And while I was in school is actually when we started to work on Winder. And we worked on a couple of other deals that we actually did while I was earning my degree. Coming out of school, I had a job offer actually from Google. And I had a job offer from Microsoft, which is where
this was pre-IPO days for Google.
Pre-IPO, yeah. I had actually had a business school class with Eric Schmidt, who was the CEO of Google at the time, and that led to a job offer there. And so I graduated, and my wife and I went on a trip to Hawaii to kind of figure out exactly what we wanted to do. And while I was there,
it was a tough decision.
It was a tough, finally deciding, hey, I want to move back to Utah, and we're going to go buy this 100-year-old dairy. What do you guys think about that? You know, that was a hard thing to explain to.
100-year-old dairy or one of the hottest startups pre-IPO, Google.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, Google at the time was still probably, approaching 10,000 employees. They were a big, big, great company. And I think I could have had a lot of fun there, but I wouldn't have had as much control of my destiny. And what I really wanted to do is I wanted to help, launch this platform that, eventually, at the time it wasn't called anything. It's become Dolphin Capital Group. So I graduated in June. We completed our first kind of bigger deal in Winder Farms in August, and then we were kind of off to the races.
So this is a great story, and I'm getting into a little bit of a sensitive subject here, and I hope you're okay talking about this. So financially, Google probably, certainly in 2007, when you're struggling, open up a new distribution center in Vegas, and Google was going public, certainly at that point, you would have been further ahead of the game financially had you gone with Google. I'm speculating here, but I suspect that I'm pretty close with the stock options and everything else. And life experiences. And I had a similar situation happen to me, very high, fast-growing company that I had a chance to join. I decided not to. I pursued a different path. And it would have paid off financially. And people ask me, do you regret that? And I go back to life experiences. And I say, no, because I love, A, I'm doing my life's work now. And B, I've enjoyed the life experiences along the way. And, fortunately, most of us, that are ambitious and hardworking, we're going to be fine in retirement, right? How did you think about that?
Yeah, financially, I actually haven't thought about it that much. I should probably go dig up the formal job offer and do the calculation on what those stock options would have been worth.
Maybe not.
maybe not. But at the same time, I think that we've done some really interesting things at Dolphin, I don't really know if I would have been better off one way or the other, because even at that point, Google was about to go public, and I'm sure the options were priced near the value that they went public at. So, but it would have been a more traditional path to go down. The path that I decided to go down was, definitely more risk, potentially equal or greater reward, but I'd be in control of it. I do what I love. I live in a community that I like. I ski every Saturday with my kids. I go mountain biking from my backyard. And no matter what I did there, I would not have the quality of life that I have here.
Well said. Well said. So let's talk a little bit more about Dolphin. What types of company? You guys are still active. You're looking mm-hmm. You're interested in investing in strong companies here in Utah. What kind of companies are on your radar screen?
Yeah. So let me describe that by telling you about some of the companies that we've invested in, because that's probably a model for companies that we would invest in going forward. And so in addition to Winder, we invested in Ragnar Relay. It's an overnight running relay series. You know, every June there's, 20,000 plus.
Grueling, yeah. It's yeah. Race. People see the people with the butterflies on the six of them saying I've done six races.
We're the most popular bumper sticker in Utah. I'm convinced of that. So that's one of our portfolio companies. And we've taken that business from, a single race in Utah to a national series now of 30 races, all over the country. We have an investment in a company that makes yoga mats in California. And they're the leading provider of yoga mats, and they're growing like crazy. So what we like to invest in is businesses that are beyond the startup stage. So they've had some measure of success, and what they're looking for is a financial partner to help them grow. And so typically the companies, they're generating revenue, they've proven their business model a bit, and now they need to ramp up that growth. That's what we like to invest in.
And do you like, there tends to be groups that like after the investment, they're in control of the investment, and then there tend to be groups that like to partner with the existing management team. Do you have a preference one way or the other?
We don't have a preference. What we don't want to be is, we want to have a meaningful seat at the table. And so if we invest in a company, we want to have more than, a single board seat. We want to be able to meaningfully participate in the company. We'd rather have a smaller, more concentrated portfolio of companies we love and that we're involved in versus to have a very diversified portfolio.
Yeah. And, one of the things I love, you and I have talked offline about the Ragnar investment. And that was really two or three guys that were passionate about these races. They kind of accidentally got into the business. And by partnering with you, you were able to give them the resources and the advice in order to not only follow their passion and do a business that they're passionate about, but also do it in a way that was profitable and created a good, strong business. And it's amazing. You guys are all over the nation now. I think of it as just a Utah thing, of course, because I live in Utah. But I saw one the other day. It was somewhere in Tennessee, and I was like, really? There's a Ragnar race in Tennessee? Yeah. How many races are there nationwide?
There's just under 30.
Really?
Nationwide, okay. Yeah. And that's what it was. It was two passionate entrepreneurs just graduating from college who had put on one race and had a vision of putting together this national series. And so that's the kind of thing that we love to invest in. Passionate entrepreneurs, fuel them with capital, and let them go.
Great. So let's wrap up with talking about what's next for Winder, what's next for Dolphin, and what's next for you.
Yeah. Oh, so what's next for Winder? It's continued market expansion. And so we now have our foothold in Southern California. Our vision is we really want to be the dominant home delivery provider in the Western U.S., focused on farm fresh food. And so that's the vision that we've laid out for ourselves, and we're going to continue to execute on that. As far as Dolphin is, we're looking for those next platform businesses. And so, companies that we can be interested in, that we can fuel growth in, that's what we really like to do, is invest in growth versus invest in, financial engineering of a company. That's not us. It's really about, building a business. And for me, who knows?
More mountain biking out of your backyard,
exactly.
More skiing on Saturday with your kids. Life,
absolutely.
Life is good.
Yeah.
Mike Dutton is the Chief Executive Officer of Winder Farms and a partner at Dolphin Capital. It might sound a little bit hokey, but Winder really has become a part of Utah's heritage. I thank you and your partners for being such good stewards of the company, and I wish you all the best going forward. Mike, thanks again for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thanks, Doug.
Today's show was recorded at the KCPW Studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. You can hear our show on iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KCPWBottomLine. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.